We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Blessed are you for coming on Fridays. Of course, the other week you haven't heard this story of one of Australia's great scholars on the book of Revelation, who in fact has written a commentary on it. He was approached at a convention by a very earnest man who said, what do you think about the millennium? Now, if you're a speaker and you go to these big interdenominational dues where all kinds of people from all kinds of theological and ecclesiastical backgrounds arrive, a question like, what do you think of the millennium, is one of the most loaded questions that you can have available to you, because you will lose a large percentage of your audience very quickly. So our friend, on hearing the question, said, well, I think about it as much as the New Testament thinks about it, which is hardly at all. It is a marvellous answer, which I am now desperately waiting to go to my next interdenominational kind of convention when someone will come and ask me. It far exceeds the one about pan-millennialism, you know, about I think it'll all pan out in the end, which I'm getting tired of. When we come to the chapter 20 of the book of Revelation, we come to a chapter of great division and confusion and disagreements with people, not only about individual verses, but about what the whole chapter is about. There are some verses which give us problems. Problems because there are so many different answers that would make sense of the same verse. But it's the chapter as a whole which is the great headache for us as to what the millennium is, where it fits into the schema of God's plans and purposes. So before we look at the chapter in any detail, I want us to spend a few moments looking at some interpretative decisions that you are going to be faced with whenever you come to this chapter. Firstly, that there are some verses which give you these problems, the problems caused by too many answers. For example, in verse 4, you find a group of people who are ruling with Christ. But that group of people could be one group of people, or two groups, or three groups. Indeed, there are two different ways in which you can get two groups of people. It's hard to know whether those who sit on the throne are also the martyrs, and are also those who testify to Christ, or whether that is three different groups of people, or whether it is two groups of people. The NIV, for example, in its translation, has it as two groups of people. It's those who are given authority to judge, and the souls of the martyrs, those who had been beheaded, who are also those who didn't receive the beast's image. See, they've got two groups. The martyrs and the testifiers, they're one group, and those who have authority to judge, another group. Or it may all be one group, or it could be three. Now, the grammar of the Greek does not allow you to make a definitive decision on that matter. It depends on the translator, and it depends on his interpretation of the passage as to what he is going to answer there, as to who the groups are. I've got my preference, I'll give it to you en route. But that is not, it's a preference. There are reasons for my preference. But there are reasons against it too, and reasons for the other preferences. Now, once you know that about a verse, then you must see, and here is the important point I want to make at this stage, that you cannot build your theory about the whole chapter on the basis of who is there reigning with Christ. Because who is there is a matter of open controversy, which there is no way of solving it. Likewise, how they got there. Or they got there by being brought to life, the first resurrection. But what is the first resurrection? Is it a physical resurrection? Is it a spiritual resurrection? It depends on what you think the chapter is about, as to whether you will think it is one or the other. Some will think it's not a resurrection of the body at all, it's just the souls coming to life again. The beheaded bodies have souls, I don't know if they've got heads or not left with them, but they are going to reign, and it's about the intermediate state of people who have left their bodies. You cannot answer that from the passage itself. You'll get your answer from elsewhere. And that being the case, you mustn't build your theory of the millennium on those verses, but rather you must seek to build the theory of the millennium on the verses which are straightforward and over which there is no controversy and no disagreement, or the disagreements there can actually be nailed down and shown to be one case or the other. Second interpretative matter to notice is the little word literal. This is a warning for you, that's all, that there are all kinds of people who will say to you, well, look, just when it comes to the Bible, I just take it literally. I mean, all I'm concerned about is the literal millennium. Now, that is a piece of drum thumping and does very little for the whole discussion. Everybody wants to take it literally. The question is, how do you take it literally? You see, I take it literally, but by literally I mean, and I always seek to interpret the Bible literally, and I always mean the same thing, that is, to seek to understand what the author meant. That is what seems to me to be literal interpretation. So when the psalmist says, "Hop ye hills for joy," I have sufficient poetry in my soul to work out that he's not actually expecting the hills around the countryside to go into some kind of seismic convulsion. I think he's saying that the people of the land are to be happy, and that is to take it literally. I think the person who really does expect the hills to move is being what I would call literalistic. I don't think that is taking it literally. I think that is to actually misunderstand the passage completely. Now, nobody takes Revelation 20 literally that I've met up with. Indeed, you'll find you can't, because it keeps on contradicting itself. A whole of mankind is killed, and then a few chapters later, a third of mankind is killed. Very difficult, a third of nothing that is killed in the second one. You wonder how they're killed, a third of nothing. You don't take it literally like that, because it's not that kind of piece of literature. You do take it literally, I hope, in trying to seek what the author is meaning by it. Now, what did he mean by the 1,000-year rule of Christ? He may have meant a precise 1,000-year period of time when Christ rules. That's maybe what he means. If that is the case, then take it literally. It may be that he means a great long period of time. Maybe 1,000 years, maybe 20,000 years. A great long period of time. If that is what he means, then take it literally. Whatever he means, that is what we should try and find out. And just to say I take it literally is to beg the question, because you've still got to ask, what do you mean by literally at that point? Third interpretive comment to make before we really get underway is the importance of background. Nearly everybody, indeed I think everybody, but I'm just not quite sure I want to say it, nearly everybody brings their interpretation of Revelation 20 from elsewhere into the chapter, rather than finding it in the chapter and taking it out. We all read our whole view of the end of the world into chapter 20, and we seek to show that our view of the end of the world is consistent with chapter 20. Now, I think everybody does that, but most people think that they get it out of chapter 20 alone. But I think that's a fiddle, and I'm not even sure that that's the right thing to try and do. For when you come to a part of the Bible that is very difficult, it seems to me a good method to actually go to the other parts that are very clear and straightforward and explain the difficult in the light of the simple, straightforward, clear statements of Scripture. It's not altogether a bad method to bring in from the rest of Scriptures an understanding that will help you elucidate chapter 20, which is difficult. The key to doing it, though, is to acknowledge that you do it, to understand that is what you're doing. Most people do it, in fact, I believe all of them do it, but most of them don't acknowledge that they're doing it. And that then leads them into difficulties. Not only should you bring in, it seems to me, the whole Bible, but also the book of Revelation and your understanding of what the rest of the book is about will influence the way you read chapter 20. Now, there is one view of the whole Bible to which I wish to disassociate myself at this stage, and those of you who come from that particular school will then find dissatisfaction with the rest of the study, but you can come and talk to me about it later and we'll work it out. That is a view known as dispensationalism, of which some of you are adherents and of which most of you have never heard. Dispensationalism is a view which sees that God deals with people in different ways at different periods of history, different dispensations, different ways of governing. It can be governing them by the law or by the kingdom or by the grace of the gospel or by the millennium. In different eras, different epochs, there is a different administration, a different way of God and man relating to each other. And the millennium is, of course, then one of these great dispensations. I think that view is wrong, in the rest of the scriptures. And therefore, I don't spend much time, in fact, no more time, countenancing here in this chapter. It is not the way in which the New Testament treats the Old Testament. And I think that can be demonstrated fairly clearly in black and white. And therefore, their particular view of the millennium seems to me to be an irrelevance. So much for dispensationalism. Come and talk to me later, because I'm sure there are some here. Now, in terms of the book of Revelation, though, we have discovered many things in our way through. We have discovered, for example, that the writer uses a very colourful, characteristic symbolism, where there's dragons and beasts and crystal seas and all kinds of highly symbolic creatures running around the countryside, which rarely are to be taken other than metaphorically. We have seen also that he uses the symbolisms in numbers and colours, that certain colours, like the colour white, usually mean victory or symbolise victory. Colour red, black, grey, so on. Different colours have different meanings. And different numbers have meanings other than their numerical value. The number 7 or 10 or 10,000, number 42 or 3.5, all have different meanings other than numerical meanings. We've seen too that not only does he use symbolism, he uses a lot of Old Testament allusions, especially allusions to the prophets around the time of the Babylonian exile and restoration. And much of his explanation and understanding of the end of the world is done in terms of the Babylonian exile and restoration. And to understand the end of the world, that is a place in which we're to turn back to understand, he would point us to. We also see that as a pattern, he has a very structured book where there's a series of cycles of seven things. A letter to seven churches, seven seals opened, seven trumpets blown, seven bowls poured out. But there are this series of cycles which are not so much sequential, the cycles, but rather, as I've suggested, action replays, where you keep on seeing certain events happening, the same event happening, but you keep seeing it from different perspectives, from different angles, as if you've got a series of TV cameras watching the same football try, or six at cricket, or tennis ace, or if you play some other sport, you do that too. You're watching that one action take place, but you're watching it first from this side of the field, then from that side of the field, then from way up in the grandstand, and then from close in where you hear the grunt as well. Now, that kind of sequence of visions is not a sequence of events, because it's the one event. And we've seen that that is the kind of pattern that happens through the book of Revelation. Where are we up to in this stage in Revelation? Well, in chapter 17, 18, we saw the great city Babylon, the great enterprise of rebellious man against God, and we saw it destroyed in chapter 18. We saw the joy of heaven in chapter 19, because then comes the wedding of the Lamb. And then after the wedding of the Lamb, we saw the rider on the white horse coming in conquest, coming in victory, to the great battle of verses 17 through to the end of the chapter, a battle that is over as soon as it starts, when all the nations of the world and all the kings and all the people are gathered together and destroyed and eaten by the birds. Then in chapter 20, we come to the millennium in verses 1 to 6. Then after the millennium in verses 7 to 10, we see the great battle take place. And then verses 11 to 14, we see in chapter 20, we see the judgment throne set up, and the judgment of the world, and chapter 21 following, we see the new heavens and the new earth. There are the events that are being described in this series here. Now, there are four basic schools of thought about what you do with the chapter as a whole. And I thought if we outline those first, then when we come to look at the verses in detail, we'll be able to think through which of those best suits the chapter as we can understand it. Three of them are fairly common. There's a fourth that's around at the moment in our church and our campus here, and so I've suggested it to you, although it's not nearly as common. They are the pre, post, A, and apocalyptic. Now, so as to make sure that you got your notes accurately, what I've done, so as to make sure I've explained it accurately, what I've done is I've asked Michelle to run off for us descriptions of the pre, post, and amillennial views on the front of our outline, which you will now stop looking at like good children and turn to the middle. That is for you to take home so that you can keep a record somewhere of what they are. All of those are are quotations from the book by Michael Wilcox called I Saw Heaven Opened, which is a commentary we've kept on advertising to you and keep on selling out, so you must come earlier in the week if you want to buy it. I like the commentary for lots of reasons. One of them, though, is that he is able to explain other people's point of view with great fairness. Indeed, from just reading those three accounts, which you're not doing now, from just reading those three accounts, you couldn't really work out what his point of view is. Of course, he presents each of them fairly. Mind you, he goes on to tell you what his point of view is, quite without any shadow of a doubt what he thinks, but he does present everyone's point of view fairly. The first two of the viewpoints, actually the pre and the post, are looking for a specific 1,000-year rule here on Earth. Not necessarily an exact 1,000 years, I mean 995 will do, but a great long period like 1,000 years here on Earth. The third and fourth views, the amillennial and apocalyptic, they're different in that they are looking for a symbolic period of time or a symbol in the 1,000. They are not looking for a specific 1,000-year rule here and now. The premillennialists are very common in the United States of America, but they still might be right for all that. You find them in certain denominations like the Southern Baptist, the Brethren movement, and so forth. You also find them in many of the sects of Christianity, of Christendom, such as the Christadelphians or the Jehovah's Witnesses, but that doesn't make them wrong either. They're all dispensationalists, the premillennial, but not all premillennialists are dispensationalists. George Eldon Ladd, G.E. Ladd, has written a commentary on the book of Revelation. He's a premillennialist who is not a dispensationalist. In fact, spends a lot of time telling you what's wrong with dispensationalism because he is so commonly accused of it. And it's a very excellent commentary, as indeed all his books are, well worth reading. G.E. Ladd on Revelation, very readable, very helpful commentary. The key idea of premillennialism is the belief in the sequences, that what is being described here is a sequence of events, that chapter 19 describes for us the return of Jesus, the coming of the Messiah on the white horse in victory, the return of Christ. Chapter 20 describes for us what happens after the return of Christ, that is, the millennium, and then after the millennium, the judgment. Then after the judgment, the new heavens and the new earth. So what chapter 20 is about, the millennium, is a 1,000-year period of history here on earth, I mean of life here, where Christ and his people reign for 1,000 years after the return of Jesus. So they're called premillennialists because they believe that Jesus returns pre the millennium, before the millennium. Jesus returns, then the millennial rule is set up on earth for 1,000 years, then the judgment takes place, then the new heavens and the new earth. That is premillennialism. You get it in lots of phrases. For example, in that book by Hal Lindsey called, it's not called that, it's called Satan is Alive and Well and Living on Planet Earth. Right? That is, he believes that Satan is not bound at the moment. He is alive and well living on earth. He's not bound and in the abyss. That doesn't happen, according to Hal Lindsey, until after Jesus returns and the millennial rule is set up. That's premillennialism. Postmillennialism, post-mills, believe that Christ comes after the millennium here on earth. It's a fairly uncommon view today. You find it, that doesn't make it wrong, of course, you find it amongst Reformed and Calvinist circles, by and large, or writings of men like Boitner. Christ's return in judgment is described, they say, in chapter 19 and in chapter 20, and that this is an action replay. That is the idea of, we're not seeing a sequence of events, but a sequence of visions. And so chapter 19, the great battle that takes place there is Armageddon, and chapter 20, the great battle that takes place, is the same battle, namely Armageddon. But he's stopped in the middle of his description of Armageddon to tell you about something that happened before Armageddon. That is the millennial rule of Christ, the 1,000-year rule of Christ. They look for the great golden age of the gospel, when people everywhere will come under the sound of the gospel of Jesus Christ, be converted and set up the rule of peace and prosperity here in this world. They're especially concerned for the conversion of the Jews and the fulfillment of the prophecy of Romans 11 about all Israel being saved. And they've got a great concern for in their interpretation and understanding of the chapters Romans 9 through to 11. It was a very popular notion at the time of the Reformation, a time when people thought that the great new age of the millennium would be set up, and when, of course, the beast of Babylon had been overturned and they thought that beast in Babylon lived somewhere in Italy. It was also a popular view during the 19th century in Britain, where the mighty British Empire was spreading out across the world and with it taking the gospel of Jesus Christ, and people could see the nations coming under the sound of the gospel, and they were looking forward to the beginning of the great period of 1,000 years where the gospel would reign in the world, and after which Christ would return, because he arrives post the millennium. It's a fairly unpopular view today. The amillennialists, and the apocalyptic people say, no, no, the 1,000 years must not be taken in that kind of numerical value. The way in which the numbers are used in the book of Revelation is a way of symbolism. And so 1,000 years is just a great long period of time, a complete period of time, a not broken into period of time. Like 7 years would have done just as well. Great long period of time is going to take place. So far it's been 1950 years or so since Jesus. It could be another 10,000, or that could be long enough. You don't know until when Christ returns. That is, the amillennialist says, we are now living in the millennium. That is now the event. And the 1,000 is not the significant feature of it, the precise number. That's not the feature of it at all. The feature is that Satan has been bound. And he was bound back with Jesus in his life and ministry and his death and resurrection. The stronger man has come and bound the strong man and is plundering his goods, Mark chapter 3, Luke chapter 11. Jesus in his crucifixion has brought the evil one under judgment. And now, whereas before only the Jews could know of God, since Jesus, all the nations have come to know of God. And see, Satan used to actually rule the nations, but now through the gospel of Jesus, the nations can come into an acknowledgement of God. And so Satan has been bound. And you can check it out here. There's very few of us sitting here today who come from a Jewish background. There is the illustration of the binding of Satan. Now, the premillennial and postmillennial people say, well, if Satan is so bound, how come the world's in the mess that it's in? Where is the golden age of the millennium now if Satan's bound? Indeed, doesn't Paul say in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 that the God of this world has blinded their eyes from seeing the truth of the gospel? And so he says, well, that's a funny kind of binding. It doesn't seem bound at all. The apocalyptic man actually moves the amillennial position just one stage further and says, no, look, he's not interested in a length of time at all. The numbers in the book of Revelation really are a numerical value in any way, even symbolic numerical values. It's just talking about the completion of the binding. That it, just like it says he's got chains and locks and a door and the seal, so he's 1,000. He's a way of numerically saying the same kind of thing again. It's just building the picture up of he is completely bound up. He's properly bound up. He's bound up the way he should be bound up. Now, you see, that's a variant of the amillennial view, ultimately, because what he is saying is, we are now in the millennium. It is now happening. There are the four views. Let us turn to the passage itself and see what we can understand of the passage. First, the structure of the chapter is very easy to follow, really. Verses 1 to 3 is about binding. Who bound whom? We see an angel who is unnamed binding up Satan, who has got many names. Previously we'd seen the Satan, the dragons or siders, dealt with in chapter 19. And here starts another vision. Not in sequence, because it doesn't say, then after this I saw, but rather, and I saw. It could be starting a new section altogether, for all we know. There's a discontinuity between chapters 19 and 20. Well, having said that, you can see there's advantages to the premillennialists and there's advantage to the amillennialists. See, the premillennialists will say, if Christ is the one who bound Satan, why is it just an angel that is binding Satan at this point? The amillennialist says, if it's all sequential, why does he start up just and I saw as if it was a new section? You can't answer it, can you? So you press on further down. How is he bound up? Well, he's bound up good and proper, isn't he? It's not for destruction, notice, but there are chains and there's locks and there's the prison of the great abyss, which is his home. He's under house arrest, really. He's locked up and sealed and kept there. But he is kept for from deceiving the nations. The idea of him being locked up properly, that you might catch in the apocalyptic idea of the thousand, has its strength to it, because he is locked up properly. But yet I don't think it's right, because you'll notice that time is still an element of it. Until the thousand years were ended, and after that, he must be set free for a short time. It seems to me that length of time is a consideration. Not necessarily exactly 1,000 years, but time, sequence, does have some part to play here. So I'd vary from that apocalyptic view which you hear around these days. But notice the key things about his binding up, the how and the why. The key really lies in the fact that he is bound up until he must be released for a short time. Now, that end of verse 3, where it talks that way, is one of the verses that irritates me, and I'm always glad when a verse irritates me. Because when there's a verse that irritates me, then I know that I don't understand the Bible properly. I know that anyway, but I know I don't understand this part properly. Right? When they say the Hebrew here is obscure? The Hebrew is never obscure, just the translator. He's the only obscure part. The writer knew what he meant. The translator doesn't know. Well, when I say the Bible's obscure, I really am saying my mind is obscure at this point. I don't understand properly. So when I come to a difficulty in the Bible, I rejoice. It does seem funny, doesn't it, that Satan must be released. Why? Why must he be released? Well, I know why he must be bound up. He must be bound up to stop deceiving the nations. Why must he be released then? Well, you think, well, only so as to deceive the nations. Why would God want the nations deceived? What is the purpose of it? The word must is as emphatic in the Greek as it is in the English. He must be released for the purpose of deceiving. But why? It's at this point that I actually came to a great breakthrough in understanding the book of Revelation, and it's built on firm foundations too, because everyone actually agrees with it in the commentaries, although most of them don't see its significance. How does he deceive the nations? Most people immediately jump on to the idea that he deceives the nations by getting them to reject God, by rejecting the gospel, or by living in warfare and difficulty and, you know, Falkland Islands and the rest. The amillennialists say, well, you see, before Christ, they rejected God, but since Christ, Satan's been bound so that people do perceive Jesus, and so they are no longer deceived. The premillennialist says, but still, people are not turning in their millions to the gospel of Jesus. Certainly, all kinds of non-Jews are here in this Bible study, but there's more people outside than inside, aren't there? Satan still seems to be ruling this world. Neither of those views, though, pays attention enough to chapter 20. Here is the problem of reading in your views from elsewhere. Because chapter 20 says he must be released for a short time, presumably to deceive the nations. And down in verse 7, he is released after 1,000 years. And he does deceive the nations. If we want to understand what it means to deceive the nations, we will find out down in verse 7, rather than in our theory about the whole millennium, which we've picked up from elsewhere. But before we go to verse 7, why don't we read the verses that follow? Verses 4 to 6, which speak of the millennium. We'll deal with those first. The account of the reign of Christ occurs in verses 4 to 6. There are big problems in it, as I've outlined already. The problems which are translation problems in the end, and therefore unresolvable. Who are the people who are reigning with Christ, and how do they come to life? I believe that it is all Christians. That is my preference. I believe that because I don't think you can answer it from the passage itself, firstly, and secondly, because from the rest of the New Testament and the Scriptures, it would lead me to think that that is who he has in mind. That is, what they are doing is serving as priests of God, reigning with Christ as priests of God. And what will happen to them is that they will avoid the second death. Well, all Christians avoid the second death because their name is written in the Book of Life, and all Christians are priests who reign with Christ. It seems to me that there's no reason to think that there is a special group of Christians who will be doing exactly the same thing as all Christians will be doing. That is my preferences, which I am reading into the passage, because it's impossible to work it out from within the passage. How are they brought to life? Well, again, you see, the premillennialist, he believes in a bodily, physical millennium. And so he will say it must be the physical resurrection that is being spoken of here. The post-millennialist, he believes in the rule in this world now before Jesus returns. And so he will tend to say that it's a spiritual resurrection if it's all Christians that are meant, or if it's only some Christians like the martyrs, well then it'll be a bodily resurrection. The amillennialist will believe that the millennium is in the here and now, and therefore must believe in the spiritual resurrection, of which there is good evidence in the New Testament, such as in John 5 and Colossians 3, that we have been raised up with Christ to sit with him in the heavenly places now, Ephesians chapter 2. How it happens? Well, it depends on your view of what the millennium's about, as to how you think it happens. But notice what happens, because that is what is very important here. What happens? Nothing. That's what happens. That is the extraordinary thing about the millennium. People are all looking forward to this great millennial rule, or they believe we're in the great millennial rule. But what you're told happens in the millennial rule is nothing. You see, you don't know if people are going to live in prosperity and peace, security and safety, happiness or joy. The only thing you know is that they're blessed, happy, fortunate, whatever you want to translate it, they're blessed because they're going to miss out on the second death. And what they're doing is serving God as priests. That is all that you know is taking place. None of the descriptions of everyone standing around singing the hymns of joy and happiness, holy, holy, none of that. You're not told what we're doing. You're only told that they're priests serving God, and they are the fortunate ones because they won't be facing eternal death. That is an extraordinary feature of millennial understanding, because most people will go into great details telling you what the millennium is going to be like, when this chapter doesn't tell you anything, and it's the only chapter that mentions it.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.